Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I want everybody to see you for what you are. The best kept secret in the NFL. You are the man. You ready?
Yep.
Let's go. Let's walk.
My name is Jerry Maguire. I'm a sports agent. You could say I'm at the top of my game, but something just isn't right.
Jerry Maguire!
What can I do for you,
Rod?
Show me the money.
Get off my face! Show me the money! Money!
Can you sign my card?
Sorry, little fella. I can't sign this brand of card. Only Pro Jam Blue Dot cards.
And lately, it's getting worse.
I came here to let you go.
Pardon me?
I came here to fire you, Jerry.
Don't worry. I'm not going to do what you all think I'm going to do, which is just flip out!
Who's coming with me?
Who is coming with me?
I will go with you.
Dorothy Boyd. Thank you.
We're going to be okay because I am going to take my one client and we are going to go all the way.
Help me, Rod. Help me help you. Help me help you.
Hello and welcome to Rewatchability. We are an Entertainment One podcast on the Entertainment One Podcast Network. And we're here to entertain you.
Are you not entertained?
Give us a thumbs up or thumbs down, like the Gladiator. We are here to talk about a pretty big movie from 1996, but before we get into it, I just want to thank our Patreons. Thank you so much for going to patreon.com/rewatchability and throwing us some change there.
Show us the money!
Rob's been waiting all week for that.
And I just wanted to say it first.
And you get some cool things. You get the podcast free, and you get there's bonus content on there.
Everybody gets it for free. I just want to point that out.
Early and ad-free.
Oh, okay.
Is kind of what I meant. Yeah, sorry, I said free.
We're not going to start charging for this malarkey.
That's how much we believe in ourselves. It's just malarkey.
Show me the money.
Show me the malarkey.
That was Joe Biden's original slogan.
Show me the malarkey.
You know, I love the word malarkey. I use it quite a bit, and I feel like I can't use it anymore because of Joe Biden.
Oh, God.
He did say no malarkey. Yeah,
you know, the Democrats ruined so much. Mainly just the word malarkey.
If you use the word malarkey, that would be sedition.
So yeah, there's content on patreon.com/rewatchability that you can only get there. So go there, find out, take a look around, take a gander at our malarkey, and
get the VIP experience, baby.
Rob's giving you the hard sell, but you could just go there on your free time. So now let's get into this movie, 1996, Jerry Maguire, Cameron Crowe. It sounds like I'm just listing off men's names. Tom Cruise and Renee Zellweger. It was a pretty big movie. Won a lot of awards. And it was my pick this week because I really like rom-coms. Like, a lot. Too much. So,
is this a comedy?
I think that they thought they were making a comedy.
I was watching it with my wife, and she's like, Tom Cruise doesn't do a lot of comedy. And I was like, this is a comedy? We were 45 minutes into the movie.
It's kind of like a rom-dramedy.
Yeah, I mean, there's some comic parts.
Wait, this is supposed to be a romance?
Yeah, it's between the love of a man and his football job.
Yeah, it's also not a sports movie, too. It kind of falls between the cracks
really
of
anything.
Every genre that it's trying to be.
Well, it's also, you suggested it because you're like, it's the 25th anniversary. I was like, oh, great. And then I looked it up, and this movie came out in December. So you're getting a 10-month jump on the 25th anniversary of this movie.
It's the same year, JM. The anniversary is year.
Well, why don't we celebrate Halloween now as well? If this doesn't matter what day it is in the year.
While we're celebrating a year of Jerry Maguire.
Our year of Jerry Maguire. That's perfect. I would love to.
The only thing worse than 2020 and all of the horrors that it brings is dedicating this entire year to Jerry Maguire.
Well, Jay, I'm going to start with you. When did you first see this movie?
I saw it in the theater like a chump.
Oh, wow. You're bringing out the hate early on.
Well, I did not like this movie when it came out. It was in the years when I think I was starting to get into movies, and I would go see every movie nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. Mm.
And so this year that was like Shine. There was a lot.
This movie.
English Patient.
Yeah, The English Patient won. Yeah. I know Secrets and Lies was nominated. Fargo was nominated.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
This was the only studio movie nominated, apparently, from like a major studio.
Right. But the others were all like weird offshoots of, studios. True. And they're like, it's independent. And no, it's not. Yeah, I remember like Billy Crystal made jokes about independent movies. I don't remember. It was probably in song form. Anyway, I saw this movie in the theater, and this was one of the movies that, there were some others, but like this was one of them that I remember like going to see. And having that when you're a kid and you are, first getting into movies, like one of the first things you're exposed to is like the Oscars and that sort of segment of critical acclaim. And at a certain point, like when you're younger, at least for me, like I thought that meant that a movie was, respected and good in some way. And this was one of those early examples of a movie that chipped away at that assumption I had, because I did not like this movie. I remember my friend I saw it with fucking hated it, like was like angry afterwards. And we were like, what, 12? 13? He was so angry.
You were barely older than that Jonathan Lipnicki fella.
But I remember I was like, why? Because I didn't like it, but I was like, why did you hate it so much? And he was like, and I think this criticism still holds true. He said, it was the story of an asshole who by the end of the movie became slightly less of an asshole. I was like, yeah,
I like that at 13, that was like your go-to.
That's how Cameron Crowe pitched it.
Yeah. But that was all I could think of watching it this time. I was like, yeah, he was not wrong. So yeah, I wasn't a fan of this movie. I was baffled by its inclusion amongst, like, I remember like that was a huge thing for me. Was I loved Fargo when it came out. That was my favorite movie that year.
Amazing
by far
movie.
And like, yeah, I remember like even just the fact that this movie was nominated with Fargo, like, kind of made me question the entire like cinematic ecosystem at the time.
Yeah, it should have just been Fargo nominated that year, and the rest of the movies just like,
right?
No.
Like five Fargos.
Five Fargos.
What about you, Rob?
I think that I half saw this. I mean, there wasn't much to attract me to this movie. We've done a lot of Tom Cruise movies recently and talked a lot about him, like on the Roseanne episode. Oh, yeah. So I don't need to say that, I don't love Tom Cruise. He's always been like, a little bit off-putting. And I also, I don't love sports. I'm not an athletic person. I've never really gotten involved in the whole culture. I guess I collected hockey and baseball cards when I was younger, but that was sort of it. And so this movie wasn't really interesting to me whatsoever. And then later, a few years after, I did sort of, there was a period of time where I really thought Cameron Crowe might be a good director, because I really loved Almost Famous, and for me that was like a movie that seemed to tell like a personal story and connected it to bigger sort of things that I was interested in. And I started looking at the rest of the Cameron Crowe movies and seeing like what else has this guy done, but I never revisited Jerry Maguire. It was just, I don't know, there's too much about it, It's a huge movie. Everybody knows the quotes. It won a whole bunch of Oscars, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. It just didn't seem like something that I wanted to watch. But at the same time, I wanted to rewatch it this time because I wanted to give it, you know, a good chance. And I thought, yeah, maybe there is something to it. It didn't really seem like my sort of thing. As to whether it is, we'll get to that. What about you, Blaine? I know that this was your choice, and I know that you love rom-coms, but is this like a special movie for you?
No, although I did see it the year it came out. And
how many times?
I lived in the movie theater. I watched it religiously. No, I saw it the year it came out. Yeah, I think I was kind of at that age where we were going to the movies and just seeing anything we could each weekend. So I think I saw it in theaters because I remember knowing about it going into the Oscars. And that year's Oscars was, I remember, not the Oscars themselves, but just like the feeling around it. I watched with my mom and I was still pretty young, like you said, Jay, I'm like 12 or 13. And I just remember like staying up late because the Oscars always went to like 3 a.m. on a school night and just like drinking pop until late with my mom. It was just like a good memory of that and seeing people so excited to win awards. It was the first Oscars that I can remember watching.
Mom, look, everyone's happy.
Yeah. Yeah. And Cuba Gooding Jr. just like over the moon.
He's pretty infectious with his...
Man, yeah. It's, I mean, it's not like I love you like Jupiter infectious, like,
wait, what's that?
What's that guy's name? The director of Life is Beautiful.
Is that what he said?
Yeah. He was like, he just like stood on chairs and was like, I love you like Jupiter. He was like all over the place. But yeah, he was pretty, infectious. Roberto Benigni. So that's kind of what I remember most of Jerry Maguire was the Oscars surrounding it. But I do remember the lines. I remember, you know, that last scene with him and Renee Zellweger in the divorced women's group living room and all that stuff. Like I remember that stuff pretty vividly from seeing it. So I wanted to watch it again because it was one that I hadn't watched a lot of since I was a kid, but I always had fond memories of. Much like you guys, right?
So where does this sort of fit in the rom-com pantheon for you?
Like, what movies is it next to in the rom-coms?
Yeah, because, I mean, I know that you're a connoisseur of romantic comedies. Like,
I don't know if I'm
like
a connoisseur.
Sleepless in Seattle, or is this like a How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days?
I just saw that. So in between those. No, I think it's a bit more than a rom-com, because it's a little bit of a rom-com, too, you know?
Wait, what? What are the,
it's a little
what
bit
are the
of
sounds
like a
romance. You're making?
It's a little bit of romance
for bromide.
Yeah, for yes, the harmless chemical that will kill you if you eat.
I think you're right. It is more than a rom-com. I mean, it's sort of about his story sort of first, and then the romantic element is sort of like,
well, I think that
a side
because
element.
He's a self-obsessed, you know, narcissistic jackhole. That's why it's He couldn't even let the movie be called something else.
It is a really unoriginal name for the movie that Cameron Crowe spent years and years and years writing.
But what would you call it?
Under James L. Brooks' tutelage, you know? Like, there should be some other name for this. Like,
sometimes the name is just a thing. Like,
yeah, it's true.
I think it's actually a good name. Like, Jerry Maguire, that sort of tells you everything you need to know about this douchebag. It's like John Wick, you know? Like,
yeah.
John Wick tells you everything you need to know about that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, maybe not everything, but enough.
I mean, naming a movie after...
Dead Dog Wick. It's crazy. The title just gives it away.
Sometimes it works. Like, Michael Clayton, you're like... I don't know. That makes sense. But like, when they changed it from John Carter of Mars to just John Carter, it's like,
oh,
what is
work.
This? Is this like a legal thriller?
Yeah.
Oh, it's on Mars. Okay.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah. But Jerry Maguire, and it's also like the poster has it in that like kind of like handwritten font sort of thing. Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
and it's just
it's pretty soft.
Just Tom Cruise's like silhouette, like as he's laughing in some kind of
maniacal
state. It's weird. I don't know. Well, let's talk about the movie. Let's get into it.
All right. Okay. Rob, you want to run down the plot?
Yeah. Well, so Jerry Maguire is a sports agent. He represents all these different athletes, and he tries to get them endorsements for various products. He's basically, he just basically like sells them to companies, and all of his athletes, they just want to get like endorsements from Reebok and Doritos and all of that stuff. And he's starting to think that, like, hey, maybe there's something more to life than that. You know, I mean, he starts to think that, you know, there's downsides to his job. Like, he gets a little bit tired of defending people who have sex with underage women. And he also, I mean, at one point he has to go visit a hockey player in the hospital because he's been concussed for like the sixth time. And it's Toby Huss, that great character actor. And the guy's kid comes out and is like, hey, what you gonna do about my dad getting concussed all the time? Maybe, like, do something? And he just sort of deflects it with, like, some sports baloney. And then the kid calls him an asshole. And so he's like, oh, man, am I an asshole?
Okay, and just...
am I the bad guy?
I don't want to, yeah, like, spoil the end of the movie, but this is, like, a pivotal moment. Like, this is almost the thing, you know, this is the thing that inspires Tom Cruise to, like, do the thing he's about to mm-hmm. do that, you know, reshapes his entire life. But that thing is, like, yeah, this guy being concussed and his kid being mad at him. And, like, you know, flash forward to the ending, the movie's about Tom Cruise's lone client getting concussed and him signing him up for years more of that. So, like, he didn't learn a lesson at all.
Oh, it's okay because he gets the attention that he wants. That's what it's all about.
Well, I think it's also, I mean, to defend this movie, which I think is my role in this entire podcast, but I think it's also that he starts caring about this man where he didn't care about that other man. And I think he was asking himself why when this kid is like, fuck you, you're killing my dad. And he's like, yeah, why don't I care about that? So I don't know. Just to defend it. There.
Okay. Well, so his solution to this is that he is going to write a mission statement. And so he stays up all night and he writes his big old mission statement. And then he goes down to the Kinko's and gets the guitarist from Alice in Chains to copy it a whole bunch of times. Like, man, it was really tough for the grunge guys for a while there.
Is that really who it was?
Yeah,
it was. Yeah. Jerry Cantrell. Yeah. He's also very, like, you know, optimistic, which is something that you wouldn't get from most of the Alice in Chains songs. He's like, yo, yeah, this is how you do good things, by having balls. It's like, hey, you're the man in the box living in your shit. So he sends this out to all the people at his big firm, and then he realizes that that was a dumb thing to do, and he's freaking out, but it's too late. Everybody has read this thing, his manifesto. It's called The Things That We Think But We Don't Say, and he goes into work, and oh boy, he gets a slow clap, and it seems like everything's going to be okay.
Yeah, I kind of...
Or is it?
I like that because everyone's like smiling and nodding like the sharks they are and being like and taking bets on when he's going to get canned.
Finally, somebody said it. I was 35. I started my life.
How long did you give him?
About a week.
I also like how writing is portrayed in movies. Like, it's this really exciting act that you do all night with, like, he had, like, an outline that he had written spread out on the floor and, like, all these balled up sheets of paper. Yeah. And he was writing on his computer. Like, I was just like, why do you need the balled up sheets of paper? And he's, like, in his underwear doing headstands, just showing off that he's Tom Cruise. And
that's how I write. Maybe that's why I don't get anything
and
done.
Also, you know, there's a, I don't
it's
know.
If, like, it's not sexy. You're just sitting there being, like, staring out a window.
Did you guys read the mission statement?
Like, in the movie?
There's a mission statement?
Yeah, he wrote the full 25-page mission statement.
Yeah, Cameron Crowe actually wrote it.
This fucking guy.
And then he released it for, like, the DVD. I read it the beginning of it. And the beginning of it alludes to something he mentions in the movie, too, is that he, like, he said, like, I'm thinking about all these things. Like, I had two slices of bad pizza. Maybe that's why or something. It's like, is that a thing? Like, if you have like bad pizza doesn't make you write like a crazy manifesto. It gives you diarrhea. Like doesn't
and
like
it's still pretty good.
Amplify and like your senses and take you to this like far out state where you completely rethink your career. It's just like it gives you gas or like diarrhea or what, like
what kind of mushrooms are on this pizza, man? Yeah. I'm rethinking everything.
The Kinko's guy recommended a place.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, but so yeah, everything initially is okay, but then he goes out for lunch with Jay Moore, and you know nothing good happens when you go out for lunch with Jay Moore. Mostly just because you have to hang out with Jay Moore. I don't know why. I assume he's a douchebag, but
it's because of this movie.
I guess it's probably so. But he fires Tom Cruise, even though he's not his boss. But I guess he gets to do that anyway. So Tom Cruise is sort of out of a job, but they have this big race to get all of his clients because, you know, that's the sort of name of the game. And so he's, like, calling them all and, like, trying to get them to stay with him. But none of them are going to stay with Jerry Maguire. They're all going to go with Bob Sugar because he's so sweet. And
Sugar.
It seems like he's going to lose all of his clients except for one, Cuba Gooding Jr. And Cuba Gooding Jr. is a football player. I think his name is Tidwell or something like that.
Rod Tidwell.
Yeah, and you know he's not a superstar player. He is not at the caliber that some of Jerry's other clients were at. Like when he tells us about all the great clients he has, it's like, oh yeah, Jerry O'Connell, he's great at football, but he's. Doesn't really say that about Rod Tidwell. He's just, you know, but he's a guy, you know, he's there. And he's willing to stay with him, you know, after making Tom Cruise scream, show me the money at the top of his lungs to his entire office, which is fine because he's not working there anyway, right? So,
yeah. Well, it's also a weird scene because Tom Cruise's whole, like, mission statement manifesto was all about, like, it was basically just describing, like, a smaller business. it didn't seem that groundbreaking. He was like, hey, we should focus on less clients and just like give them more attention. His whole out there crazy thing he comes up with is like, hey, we should do a better job at our job. It's what it seemed like to me. But then it's kind of put to the test because he gets fired by Jay Moore and then he immediately rejects the mission statement that he wrote. Mm-hmm. He's like, I don't care about it. I want as many clients as I can. So he's scrambling to get all these clients and then he ends up being forced to just have Cuba Gooding Jr. because he's talking to him on the phone and giving him all this attention.
Well, and that's what I love about this movie is that the catalyst is this kind of like one act that he did setting up this thing that he totally regrets in the sober light of day and then is forced the entire rest of the movie to live up to this kind of one slip of empathy that he had. And I don't know. I really like that. I really like that as a journey for a character.
Yeah. I never have empathy.
It just seemed like I would have liked something more radical or something like him just being like, oh, we should pay more attention to like the clients and like do better jobs. You think like his boss would be like, oh, great, we'll call it like the platinum level and we'll charge more for it. And that's fine. I don't know. It's just like, I mean, it was based on like from what I've read, it was based on like a real thing that happened at Disney. Did you guys read that?
Yeah. No. Yeah.
And it was Jeffrey Katzenberg, but he didn't get fired. And his whole thing was about like making smaller productions and stuff and making more money that way. And it was not controversial. But then he did start making smaller productions and it was called Quibi and it failed miserably. Of course, those were physically smaller, but you know.
Yeah.
On the phone. Sorry, but yeah, I don't know. It just seemed like I just wanted it to be like crazier. It just seemed weird to me that it was such a controversial thing. Am I missing something?
I mean, I think it was about rejecting like the kind of like treating players like they're playing cards, even though they are playing cards and they have them. But it was about getting back to the soul of the sports. And same with Katzenberger's manifesto, which I read in preparation for this. Katzenberg, sorry.
Should have read his name.
Yeah, he didn't put it on, so I didn't, you know. So
it used to be Katzenberger. He shortened it to fit on a phone.
But yeah, I mean, his whole thing was that Dick Tracy came out, and because it only made its money back, everyone considered it a financial flop, when it wasn't a financial flop at all, but it was definitely a ratings flop. Like, everyone laughed at it. So he was like, let's make good movies, and that'll make us the money, but we should look at story. We should look to how we did things in the past, in our roots, which is much like this manifesto, which is like, let's not concentrate on like these big tentpole players. Let's treat everyone like they're human, and not like, you know, we're trading up each guy. We treat them all equally to try to get them as much money as possible. So there is still money involved. Like Katzenberg, his whole thing was, this is how we make more money. That's the whole manifesto. From Disney too. He just thought of doing it another way, which he did with DreamWorks instead of Quibi.
I don't know, on like Tom Cruise's like second day of being fired, just like leak the story to the press. Be like, hey, I told these guys to treat the players like human beings and they fired me. Like,
yeah. Well, and that's kind of what Katzenberg did with Eisner when the whole thing with Disney went down, when Wells was killed in that helicopter accident. That apparently Clint Eastwood was supposed to be in. It's a crazy story.
Wait, what? But like, Orson Welles was killed in a helicopter accident?
No. Frank Wells was like the number two guy at Disney. So he oversaw Eisner and Katzenberg at the time. And he kind of like, not oversaw them, but like he kind of played ball with both of them and made them both work together. But when he died in the helicopter accident, like the next day, Katzenberg was like, oh, will I be put up to the spot like you promised Eisner? And Eisner was like, no, I don't want to talk about it.
You mean I sabotaged the helicopter for nothing?
Yeah, exactly.
That was a joke.
That was expensive.
I'm sure Jeffrey Katzenberg did not murder anyone.
No, but Jeffrey Katzenberger did.
Yes.
I just want to
monster,
yeah,
and so still at large.
We don't know where he is. So yeah, so then Katzenberg was like, why didn't you put me up? Eisner was like, well, I don't want you around if you're just going to go for this job and not like before the man's in the ground. So then he fired Katzenberg, and Katzenberg went to the press and was like, I was promised the job, and he didn't give me the job. Instead, he fired me. And so then Eisner was like, I never promised him the job. We were just talking over drinks, and I said, if anything happened to Wells, like he left, then we'd consider you for the... Anyway, there's this whole big thing.
This is sounding suspicious.
Yeah, none of these people are in this movie.
But it's all what this movie was based on. So
right. But I mean, I think the thing that Jam was perhaps saying before was that, like, it's not like his mission statement has anything about exploiting the players' bodies until they die or anything like that. It's not like a greater good sort of thing. It's just like, maybe, yeah, you know, it's a little bit disappointing that his mission statement is just like, maybe there's a different way that we can make money.
Yeah that's fair.
Let's be nicer and get more Doritos deals.
But like, the fact that like just saying let's be a little bit nicer got him fired is kind of like, I don't know, that's a point in the movie too. That's like, I think, a point of the movie.
Well, I think it's part of like the culture of those workplaces at that time. Like, it was definitely like a show any weakness and you will be sort of picked off. And
yeah,
you know,
I think it's also the culture
of competitive environment
of agents, you know, of middle people.
Well, I mean, people who are basically only focused about money don't. Why would they have any morals around, like, you know, the people that they work with, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely been my experience with agents.
I would screw you guys out if there was any money in this thing.
Fair enough.
Okay, but so he does this big thing where he wants everyone to sort of, he tries to get people to come and join him in his new sort of thing. This is like the Michael Scott Paper Company arc of The Office.
I was thinking that. I was thinking, and also like how much better that scene is, because it's kind of
so good.
Supposed to be sad. I don't know. It's just, it's less silly than, somehow the sitcom version of this was less silly than the movie version.
Yeah, but only Pam goes with, I mean, sorry, only Renee Zellweger goes with him, and he also takes the fish, so that's who they've got in their office. And, it's not looking great. I should say that Renee Zellweger also went with him because she sort of, like, creepily eavesdropped on a conversation that he was having on the plane where she was, like, sort of hanging off every word that he said when he was telling this other woman about him getting engaged. She's already like has some sort of like crush or something. I mean, she says she's inspired by his mission statement, but there's a lot going on there. But also, she has a little boy who is the Jonathan Libnicki character. That's his name, right?
Yeah.
With the spiky hair and the glasses. And, oh, he's just a little cuteness. Ragamuffin.
Yeah.
But he basically like falls in love with this kid. He's like, you know, they have like this moment at the airport where I guess their meet cute is that she can't find the boy. And then he sort of conveniently comes along on the baggage motivator or whatever it's called. And you can do it. Come on, baggage. But then, and he sort of like, you know, he has like an instant sort of bond with this child. And he's like, oh, they sort of like each other. And the kid tells him facts about things like the average human head weighs 8 pounds. And Tom Cruise just tells him baloney about sports shit that nobody cares about. So it's a good relationship.
Not a sports fan, eh, Rob? All right.
But it seems like things are going to go okay for him at first, because he goes down to get his star sort of player, Jerry O'Connell, back into his agency, and he talks to his dad, Beau Bridges.
Do you think Beau Bridges, and I love Beau Bridges, but do you think maybe he's Jeff Bridges' understudy? Like, do you think this was written for Jeff and it just didn't come together?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
And I love Beau. I really do.
He's great. He is great. And I also think he's sort of perfect for this part. This is not a Jeff Bridges part.
Sure.
Jeff Bridges parts are more idiosyncratic. He's got to be wearing that T-shirt that he wears in every movie. It wouldn't fit in this. This, he's like, he's a football dad. And Beau plays a good football dad. He's got his hair combed back. It's good. And he
also,
says that...
Also, you trust Beau Bridges. You really trust this guy.
His word is like oak, which is a very strong wood, I am told.
Carve it. Make furniture out of his word.
Whoa! Hey, Jerry, how's it going?
Hey, Kush. How are you, Kush?
You remember Keith?
Yeah, Keith. How you doing?
I want him to go number one in the draft. And I want him to play.
It'll either be Denver or San Diego trading up to take him. He'll go number one.
Hell, I'll either surf or ski. I don't care.
But Denver's where he should be.
I'll give it everything.
You know I don't do contracts. But what you do have is my word. Stronger than oak.
But yeah, so they're going to go with him. It seems like everything's going to be okay, except then they go down on draft day, and Beau Bridges' word, it is not as strong as oak. It is as strong as some wood that is not very strong. Balsa. Balsa wood.
Or some of that particle board from IKEA. That's what his word
because
is
like. He's gone and signed with Bob Sugar. Jerry Maguire's nemesis. So once again, he's back in this precarious position. And, you know, at the same time, he's not really showing the love to Cuba Gooding Jr. that Cuba Gooding Jr. wants to see, you know, because he brings him down there. And he gives him the sort of walk around, but then he doesn't pay attention to him. You know, he knows that he's really focused on the star guy. And, you know, Tidwell is sort of like the second fiddle. As soon as he has something good, better coming around. There's a bunch of other stuff in this movie, too. Like, Renee Zellweger has a sister, and there's always, like, an angry group of divorcees in her living room. And this was one of the parts where I was like, oh, Christ. It's like, does Cameron Crowe, like, seem to have, like, a really fucked up view of women or something like that?
Because definitely.
He seems to both have this, like, respect and awe for single moms, right? Like, single moms are a trope in his work. I think he was raised by a single mom, assuming that his life is just, like, almost famous. But at the same time, he has this absolute contempt for these divorced women who, you know, these witches who just hang out and support each other like monsters.
I don't know if they're supposed to be monsters, but they're definitely kind of a punchline and an inconvenience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just seems like whenever, like, one of the characters that is supposed to, like, speak for, you know, the author or for us says something, it's always, like, you know, in a sort of derisive way towards them. Like, even Renee Zellweger is, like, talking shit about them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you leave my son with the divorced women's group?
Like, they seem perfectly nice.
Yeah. They brought lemon treats. Come on.
And they all look like they're part of some, like, girl rock band, too, which is weird.
And it's a violent femme.
And the other thing they use them for is not to skip too far ahead, but at the end, like, Renee Zellweger joins the group, and you're like, oh, no, she's one of these women. Maybe Tom Cruise will come back and save her from this group of sad people.
Harpies.
Yeah, so, and they shoot all, like, the first time we see them, he shoots it all, like, handheld, like, oh, this is real. And then it pulls back. It's like, oh, they're just going to be kind of, like, set dressing to make fun of.
Yeah. Yeah. But she likes him, and he likes being liked. So,
well, yeah, I mean, this is the what I think is one of the really unique things of this romance, of this movie, is that he falls for her kid first. Like, he loves this kid.
That seems creepy to me, though. Like,
no way. I mean, it's creepy because it's Tom Cruise, but, like, I don't know. I like that a lot. I think that's really.
Did you know the human head weighs 8? Have you had a free stress test?
Yeah, well, I mean, he was in a relationship prior to that with Kelly Preston, who is also a Scientologist.
Who passed away, sadly, last year.
Oh, did she? Oh, well, yeah, that's right. I forgot.
And she's good here.
She is good, but she's playing, like, a real hard ass.
And also talking about, like, Cameron Crowe's issues with women, they're like, they write her at first as, like, she's a strong female character. She's, like, a career woman, and she doesn't take shit from Tom Cruise. And the way they manifest her not taking shit from Tom Cruise is when he breaks up with her, she attacks him, like, you know.
She punches him in the face many times.
Twice. And then I thought it was in the groin.
I thought it was going to, like, cut back to, like, a record scratch moment, and it was, like, all in his head or something. But no, that actually happens in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's abuse, guys. Just call the police.
Jerry Maguire should retain a lawyer because he has so many lawsuits to file.
Get Tom Cruise's character from The Firm.
Yeah. Just Tom Cruise representing Tom Cruise, Judge. I will be playing the part of my own lawyer.
And then the judge peels off his face and it's Ethan Hunt.
But Tom Cruise and Renee Zellweger, they end up going out on a date even though they work for each other. I mean, first he comes over drunkenly and he...
Oh, this is pretty bad, yeah.
They call it a Clarence Thomas moment.
Well, he lunges at her and gropes her.
Yeah.
And then she's like, oh, you're my boss. And he's like, oh, shit, am I Clarence Thomas? And it's like, yeah. But he basically assaults her. She makes a joke about it.
Well, that's what he knows about relationships, is being assaulted. So he passes it on.
But then the scene entirely becomes about her making him feel better about the fact that he just groped her. And he's her boss. Like, it's so weird. This movie.
Yeah, no, that was pretty bad. That's a pretty bad point.
Like, this is, you know, my biggest problem, especially with, like, calling this a romance, is, like, I never once felt like Renee Zellweger was a real person. Like, she never reacted to things the way I would have expected a person to react.
I think, I don't know. It's hard. It is a product of its time, for sure. I think that might have been a normal reaction for the time, but
I mean, it's a normal reaction because she doesn't want to lose her job.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that I think the movie does pretty poorly is that she says on many occasions that she was taking advantage of him after his breakup, which isn't true in a boss, an employee relationship.
Right.
The employee can't really take advantage of the boss that much. It's more the other way around that you have to look out for. So I think that was a little bit awkward. I think just our society has progressed in a great direction from when this movie was filmed.
But it's not just that. It's like he does like creepy shit, and her role is just to like... There's like the whole first half of the movie is him doing creepy shit or like worrying shit or like... he's going to ruin our lives shit, and her, like, giggling about it.
I mean, yeah, she definitely attached herself to a man that... If we take the groping thing aside, she's attached herself to a man who's at, like, rock bottom and is very caustic and could cost her whole career, and that's why she looks for another job, you know? Like... I don't think she's like the dumbest character or not reacting normally. I think she does react normally for the circumstances, like follow her heart to this guy that has his whole manifesto. And then she sees that he's really fucking broken and is like, well, maybe I should probably
not be working for this guy and get a job in San Francisco. You know, like, I think there's some realistic reactions she has in this movie.
But also, like, I didn't even really understand, like, what her job was, because she was the accountant at the agency. And then she basically just becomes, like, a personal assistant. Like, she's doing, like, his accounting, and she's, like, doing things like picking out his clothes and, like, putting out muffins for meetings. Like,
well, and that moment when he hands her the muffins is that moment where she realizes, like, oh, shit, like, this is what I've gotten myself into. I'm now the owner of this man. Like, I'm now, like...
Yeah, that's, like, terrible. That's
exactly
awful.
Yeah, and I think that's why she goes for the other job. I think that's purposely in the script. I don't think it's like this thing that Cameron Crowe didn't mean to write. I think it's in there personally. But anyway, sorry.
But, like, being an accountant, you, like, have to go to school for that and stuff. Like, it just seems, like, weird to, like, abandon that to, like, be driving a guy to the airport. I don't know. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, and I don't think she was expecting to do that. I think she was expecting to be an accountant in his new firm.
Then that's another terrible thing he's done.
Definitely. Yeah, no. Yeah. Because, like, even in the elevator, she's like, is there going to be medical? And he's like, I have no idea what life will look like tomorrow, so I can't promise you anything, is kind of like the end result of that conversation.
This movie, like, it sets up a lot of things, like you're talking about a little bit, like things like, you know, patterns of bad behavior that this character has. And I feel like everything that happens at the end of this movie just, like, reinforces those.
Like, legitimizes that?
Yeah. Like, I mean, the whole thing we were talking about, like, where he goes to her house, where he gropes her and stuff. Like, that's, like, the day he broke up with his fiance. And, like, there is this, you know, they had this bachelor party for him with Eric Stoltz, who's in this movie for 4 seconds for some reason.
I know. It's so weird.
It seems like he should have had another scene somewhere, but maybe it's probably he got cut or floor, replaced with Michael J. Fox. I don't know.
But this whole thing, there's this whole, like, thing about, like, oh, he needs to be, like, liked. He can't be alone.
He can't be
alone.
So,
like, as soon as, like, he breaks up with his fiance, he goes straight to, like, another woman. But, like, that neediness is, to me, only, like, compounded by the end of the movie. Like, he never does anything selfless. Like, the kind of climactic, you know, rom-com scene where he confesses his love is, like, the most, like, needy, compulsive moment in my mind. Like, and
yeah, that's fair.
The most aggressive manifestation of that, like, that element of his personality. I don't know. Like, I just feel like all of these things that are bad that we're talking about in the first half of the movie, we can be like, yeah, the script did that on purpose, but I don't feel like they're resolved in a way that makes me like this guy by the end of it. And I think you're supposed to like him.
Yeah. I think, I mean, Tom Hanks was the original guy for the role.
I don't even
right?
think he could pull that off.
I think he might have been able to, but yeah, it's not great. I hear what you're saying, JM. I do think that, like, the whole he can't be alone, that stuff was probably hit too hard in the script.
Well, yeah, because they show him like an avant-garde, like, student film at his bachelor party where people keep repeating
that really hits it home. They, like, burn his black
you
book.
Can't
he can't
be alone.
He's like, they're playing Beethoven. But like, what I really like about the structure of this movie is that, like, Jerry Maguire has his heart in his job, but not in his relationships. And then Rod Tidwell has his heart in his relationships, but not in his job. And so, like, their friendship is to, like, teach each other about the and at the end of the movie, Rod really commits and really has fun and enjoys and puts his heart into his Super Bowl victory dance. I don't know sports either, Rob. So,
okay, can we talk about Rod, though, for a minute? Because this is another thing that I don't agree with fundamentally, which is what you're saying, where it's like he doesn't put his heart into it. And that's the whole thing Jerry's saying. It's like, you got to put your heart into it. And they keep saying time after time that Rod is very good. He's a very good player. He is, like, putting up the numbers that he's expected to. But, like, what Jerry wants him to do is do things like dance after scoring a touchdown. And he's like, I'm a good athlete. I'm good at my job. Like, I'm not an entertainer. Like, I'm not here to entertain you.
I'm not going to dance. He literally said.
And I fucking agree with him. Like,
Yeah.
Why should he? No, if he doesn't want to dance, don't make him dance. He's not a performing monkey. Like, I find that ridiculous. I find it like, and the thing that he does that, like,
kind of insulting.
It is insulting. Yeah. And the thing that it is literally a job where, you know, people are putting their health on the line for your entertainment. They don't have to do additional mm-hmm. entertainment if they don't want to. Like, football players are like continuously like dealing with injuries, like we see briefly at the end of the movie. And like, you know, that's enough in my mind. And I'm not a football fan, but the fact that like, yeah, that he would like have to like contrive this like performative aspect of his football playing. I don't know. It's weird. Like, on one hand, I like the fact that the movie is, you know, telling a sports story where the ending isn't just about like winning a big game or something we've seen a million times. It's about him like showing that heart. But even the heart
we
see, the thing we see him do at the end is just celebrating the fact that he's not dead, which is just kind of sad.
Big celebration.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this movie, I mean, maybe not, but I think the movie has its heart in its right place. But on like, there are things that you have to deal with when you're talking. So like, I love the structure of them teaching each other, like, put your heart in your relationship, put your heart in your job. But the way it's done, I mean, there's a whole bunch of history there too. Once you get into the racial aspects of it, it's like, it's just horrible. There's a lot of like knock-on effects that I don't think Cameron Crowe had his head around when he made this movie at all.
Well, yeah, there's one part like where, there's some weird racial stuff in this movie too, where like Moore's like, I'm Mr. Black Person or something. It's like, what? Why would anyone?
No, Tom Cruise says that.
Or is it Tom Cruise? Movie. Okay,
yeah.
It's weird.
And then,
I definitely don't trust like Cameron Crowe writing any minorities at all, especially after Aloha, you know?
We should just be glad Emma Stone didn't play the Rod Tidwell part.
There's also I think that like they make a crack at like his brother for being too radical because he's wearing like a a shirt.
I don't even remember that.
Yeah,
it's just random like line, you know.
Yeah, he throws it out in the interview at the end. Well, let's get to the end, Robles.
So I mean, the big thing is that he and Renee Zellweger, they keep going out a couple times, once or twice, and then they get married. And I mean, this is a crazy thing, especially for somebody like Tom Cruise.
Gooding Jr. He didn't like audition her or anything.
Well, I mean, Cuba Gooding Jr. is like, hey, what's up with your marriage? Because it doesn't seem to be like a real thing, you know. is she like some sort of like beard or, you know, Tom Cruise? I'm not. This is me out of character. I'm Cuba Gooding Jr. talking to.
So this actually happened with Cuba Gooding Jr. He invited his dad to set to meet Tom Cruise, and his dad.
What's his dad's
apparently
name?
Who knows? We'll never find out. We can never extrapolate. but his dad came to set and he shook Tom Cruise's hand, and apparently the first thing out of his mouth was like, okay, level with me, you gay or not?
Wait, what, really?
Cuba Gooding Jr. said in the Grimm.
Was that a come on?
Yeah, who knows? Who knows what the senior wants? But
also, Tom Cruise is playing like every scene in this movie feels like Ben Stiller's impression of Tom Cruise from around that time.
Oh,
like,
man.
It's such a cartoon. Yeah. Like, the glasses, the suits, the...
Tom Cruise playing drunk is not the way anyone should play
drunk.
No, man.
No.
And, like, everything. Like, he's constantly, oh, my God. Like, that's even, like, their first date in the restaurant. I just... Oh, it made me uncomfortable.
It's not every day you say goodbye to a woman like that.
A song for the lovers?
No.
Mm-hmm. No.
Thank you.
Oh, no. No. We work together.
Oh, really, guys, this is like an office meeting, but thank you. Thank you.
But I know what you mean. It wasn't like my marriage to Roger was any good even before.
Before?
Jerry.
What?
Let's not tell our sad story.
He doesn't act like a human being should.
And maybe that's why, you know, it's tipped off that his marriage isn't real. Even Renee Zellweger, you know, eventually clues in. Is like, wait a minute, I like you, but I'm not feeling anything back. It's like a one-way mirror or something like that. And he's like, ah, come on. And then they, like, break up for a while. Like, she's going to, you know, is that
Take
where she's
that
going
job.
To move?
Yeah. No, no, that's before. Then they get married, so she doesn't take the job.
Right, right.
I found the whole like dynamic with her kid just weird. I don't know. I like the kid. I like their scenes together. I think the kid's good and charming. But like this idea that like he likes the kid more than her, and that's why they got married. And like they're like,
yeah. I mean, that's
weird,
creepy. That's definitely not the basis for a relationship.
I mean, obviously not. But I don't think it's like. It's, I just, yeah, I don't,
think I don't think it's
like,
actually like
have a mentor.
It's not, it doesn't go to a creepy place. I'm not even like thinking it's going to a creepy place, but I was just like immediately kind of weirded out by like the fact that like, that he's just like has a relationship with her kid and not her in a way, or that she, just like a mother being uncomfortable with like her partner's like being closer to her kid. I don't know. It just felt weird.
I think it was about, it was mainly about him not loving her and not really loving her, not truly loving her, you know?
But even like the suggestion just that like he, you know, he married her so he could like still have a relationship with the kid. Cause that's even what he says when they like, and again, I'm not suggesting anything like abusive is happening. I'm just saying it's such a weird dynamic to me. I don't know.
I mean, I sort of see it because I sort of think like the trajectory that he was on probably didn't include a family, like with, you know, hard ass Kelly Preston. I mean, the way that she's portrayed in this movie, it doesn't seem like, you know, she's going to be like a maternal.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I totally understand it for the character. I think my problem is more like by the end of the movie, I don't feel like that problem is solved. You know what I mean?
Well, he should have taken them to the zoo once and then, like, you know, probably done other things with his weekends. I don't know.
To me, like, we're at the end of the movie. Like, you know, let's get into what happens at the end of the movie.
The big thing is that Cuba Gooding Jr., he's playing his big game. He's doing pretty well. He's going to take his team to, like, the next level or whatever. And he's going to do the big thing, and he gets the point almost. But then he gets a mean hit, and it seems like he's fucking going to die. And his whole family's watching on TV. Regina King plays his wife, and it's horrifying because his whole family's just watching.
Yeah, he's a free agent, so if he gets injured, then no one would pick him up the next
season. I guess that too. But it just seems like he's going to die. You know, like, no, I think it seems like his career's fucking over, man. Like, there's no coming back from a hit like that.
Well, it's also weird because, like, like I was kind of saying earlier, like, brain trauma and brain injuries are such a huge problem for professional football players.
Yeah.
Like, it's weird to me that the end of this movie is him almost dying from, like, a potential brain injury, and the, you know, the climax is him as them being like, hey, you're signed up for 4 more years of this.
It's like not another team movie. It's like, oh, you only got 2 concussions left.
Yeah.
Like, there's an early, well, like, getting CAT scans earlier in this movie, and Tom Cruise keeps saying like, well, let's just hope you don't get injured. Why would you even say that?
Why does he say that to him before he goes onto the field every day? Why does he do that to him?
Oh, remember, don't get injured.
It would be a shame if you got injured.
Don't have an aneurysm in your sleep. Just good night.
Hopefully you don't slip on the way to the bathroom and your whole career is over.
He probably has his eye set on Regina King because he just can't be alone.
What this movie did, you know, watching it this time as an adult and what I understood of football players' careers is, you know, you do have to make your money really early because you're out very early as well. Like, you retire by 30 if you make it that far. And so it's like ballerina. It's like anyone who, like, really puts their bodies through the paces. And
podcasters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my back slightly hurts. So I think it's kind of, I don't know. I do think it's kind of cool. I mean, not cool. I think it's commendable that these men found a way to make enough money for them and their family. And they're almost putting their lives on the line. I wish they didn't have to do that. I don't think. I mean, I don't watch football. I don't agree with it. But, like, I don't know. I kind of respect it a little bit.
It just seems like the natural conclusion of this movie should be like, oh, maybe your life is worth more than the sport. Like, maybe get out now. Like, maybe, like, it seems like Tom Cruise should put his arm around Cuba Gooding Jr. and be like, buddy, it's time now. You've had a good run. Let's go out now. You know,
and that,
before he dies.
That would almost be like the ultimate that would like wrap up the thing we learned about that the beginning, where he's like, I'm going
to
treat.
And then he's like, I don't have a job. Let's move to San Francisco.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Like his whole thing was like, let's care more about the athletes as people than about like the money they bring in. And like, the ending should have been like him convincing him to just retire and be with his family or do something else.
Yeah, getting him into like coaching school or something. It's like, you can, you know, be one of those guys who now you're the coach.
Or he's like a commentator because he's so quick with words.
He would be a great
stuff.
Commentator.
He would be great.
Like, you got to think about your post-game career.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a much better ending. Yeah, for sure. Because then Jerry's actually like a whole person where he like saved a person's life and he's like, wow, I've been an asshole for so long and I finally know that I'm in love with this person. And so he feels like a little change that can go back. But this, you're right. Like, get more concussions.
And in terms of like the relationship stuff, because here we're building up to like the big, you know, the famous moment from the movie where, but
Rosebud. No, that's in the line.
But he goes back to Renee Zellweger's house or her sister Bonnie Hunt's house and has the whole like "you complete me" speech.
Mm-hmm.
But even that,
you have me at hey.
But even that, okay. First of all, he barges in and is very aggressive.
Get out of here, women.
But he
go find men.
Get on your brooms and fly away.
The patriarchy has arrived.
But he just is like, I'm looking for my wife. Like I would be
you bitter old crones.
I still own her.
Yeah. And then he gives this whole speech. But even that was like not inspired by like anything meaningful in their relationship. It was him seeing Cuba Gooding Jr. talking about his wife after his like near-death experience. So again, it seemed less like he actually has chemistry with this woman or like is in love with this woman who doesn't think he loves her, and more like
it's a pretty hard come to Jesus moment for sure.
Like it's like
we don't see him change in any outward way.
It's just like, for me, it's just like a repetition of that same pattern as him being like, oh, fuck, I don't want to be alone either. I'm going to love that woman the same way he loves his woman. Yeah, it just seems like so dumb.
It's almost as like the end of this movie should have been like, you complete me, but I really need to figure myself out for a couple years. So
yeah,
you go to San Francisco, let's keep on talking, but I got to do me for a little bit. I'm going to go to a
Again, like it seems like the logical extension of what was established earlier for this character. You can't be alone. You keep jumping into relationships when it's not a good idea. Like, the ending of this movie should have been like, hey, I really do love you, but I need some time. I need some time to figure out who Jerry Maguire is.
Yeah. Be a big brother. You don't have to marry somebody to hang out with a kid every once in a while.
It's the only way to get into Legoland, okay? Well, I need it.
That is true. That is
true. I needed to get married.
He says, you complete me, because that's what, like, they saw, like, someone signing that when they first...
Yeah. Well, it's actually not in ASL. It they were signing, you make me whole, which I guess is you complete me, but...
you make me whole. And then one of the divorcees...
I want to fuck your whole.
Jesus
Rob
Christ.
Made a grosser joke.
I'm sorry.
I was gonna make
the end of this movie.
She doesn't even read sign language. that was a lie.
It's just the dirtiest talk in the elevator. That's amazing.
You wouldn't know. Most people don't speak that language.
Okay, so that's Jerry Maguire. They get together.
Wait, you didn't say you had me at hello. She says you had me at hello, and I don't think he said hello. Did he say hello? Yeah.
No.
Fuck this movie.
No, maybe he does. Maybe he's like, I'm looking for my wife. And then he takes a breather and goes, hello.
He probably said it sarcastically, like, hello.
I'm here. I'm the man in the room. Okay, we get it, Tom Cruise.
Can I have some snacks, please? Come on. How about a sandwich?
I just watched a football
game. I'm Jerry Maguire.
It says so in the title. There's no question mark after it. So that's the movie. They walk by the baseball diamond that was... in Hook, and they end the movie. And
that would be great if they seamlessly blended. Like, just as Jerry Maguire walked away, like Robin Williams walks in and Hook begins. They're like, oh, I guess I'm watching.
Well, Robin Williams
figures into this movie in the behind the scenes. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to be right back with some trivia questions and such. So keep the earbuds in your ears, buds. God damn, I hate myself.
Help me help you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, welcome back to Rewatchability. We're talking about Jerry Maguire. Talking about Tom Cruise, which we've been doing a lot of lately.
Yeah, we have to have a moratorium of Tom Cruise for the next little while. I don't think I can deal with any more.
The new Mission Impossible comes out.
The
new Top Gun comes out. He has so many movies. All right, so you've already answered many of my questions already, but let's see if I can't come up with some on the fly. So which Amy Mann song was in this movie when it came out in theaters?
Which Amy Mann song?
Yeah.
And it's not on the movie anymore?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good follow-up question that really throws a wrench into the trick question I had. So Amy Mann wrote Wise Up for this movie that was later used in Magnolia, which is another Tom Cruise movie.
Whoa.
And Cameron Crowe.
A much more likable character.
Yeah.
Arguably the same. Maybe he changed his name in the intervening years.
Yeah, I would buy he just that. Grew up, he left. And she wrote the song. Cameron Crowe loved the demo, hated the finished version, refused to put it in the movie. And then a year later, the movie came out in theaters, and then he listened to the song again, fell in love with the song again, and then put it back into the movie for DVD release. It's a weird thing he did to Amy Mann there. Yeah, yeah. So he didn't want it in the movie, and then he listened to it a year later and was like, I was wrong. Amy Mann, can we put your song back in the movie for DVD?
She was like, you had me at hello. I'm going to pay you.
This is why people like, this is Mandela effect shit. Like, now everyone's going to be like, I didn't think Amy Mann was in the movie, but now, you know, it's confusing. And, you know, talking about the music.
I didn't know that Nelson Mandela was in this movie.
Talking about the music, I didn't mention this, but
long road.
Another weird thing that stuck out to me was, because he's always got great, you know, songs in his movies.
Yeah.
This one's got Tom Cruise belting out Tom Petty in the car for some reason.
Oh, my God. Just what we needed.
Yeah.
They released that. Oh, my God. Jerry O'Connell singing Something in the Way. Yeah. That should have been a single.
I know. So good. So
what
good.
What a moving tribute to Kurt.
They should. Yeah. Hopefully they'll do a slider special where he is the lead singer of Nirvana. It's Nirvana World.
Oh my God.
I was going to say the end of this movie ends with Bob Dylan with Shelter from the Storm.
Right.
Track from one of the, you know, it's like the happy ending where he's back with his wife. And then they play a track from one of the most famous breakup albums in rock history.
I know. It was like such a sad ending to like this hopeful, like this, what should be a hopeful ending.
I give them
it's
a
weird.
Year.
You know, I found, I mean, obviously Cameron Crowe is really great at licensing songs for his movies. He knows lots of people in the music world who will give him free songs, I guess, or give him deals. But I found in this movie, like, a lot of them, they didn't feel tonally right for the scene. And there's like, Shelter from the Storm. I don't think that needed to be there. And sometimes it really just seems like he is just like sucking the meaning or like the experience of the song and trying to inject whatever bland scene is sort of happening.
Look no further than Elizabethtown. He like relies on the songs for the entire, it should have just been a music video because there's no story worth watching there.
Yeah.
I thought you liked that.
Okay.
Movie.
I think it's a fascinating failure. I mean, that's the thing about Cameron Crowe. I do think he's like, sort of an interesting artist. I mean, he has a great arc, you know, that whole like writing for Rolling Stone when he was young and, you know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And like, I mean, he was a big director for a while there, but he's so bad sometimes.
Yeah.
And like, it makes you wonder, like, is he just terrible and he managed to like somehow do something that seemed good, or does he have like some good senses and he's just like sabotaging himself somehow with like, you know, oh, what if I just put like some more Bob Dylan songs in this, you know, or what if I just put my favorite Eagles track in that, whatever, or my favorite Eagles in the movie.
I think he's a good director. He just is not good sometimes. And I think that's allowable when you're practicing your art. I don't know. Like
What did he direct that's good? I'm not a big Cameron Crowe fan. Okay, apart from this. I know people like Almost Famous. I don't care for it.
Almost Famous? I love Almost Famous.
I like Almost Famous. I mean, was Vanilla Sky good? I can't remember. What did we say?
We watched it. I can't remember. I remember thinking it was okay, but you just copied it from a whole other movie.
Fast
Times at Ridgemont High. He wrote that.
There you go.
That's a pretty big one.
There's something there. Okay, so if you're hating on Cameron Crowe, this will make you hate him even more.
How many puppies has Cameron Crowe put in a pillowcase and thrown in?
No. So this actress worked with Ben Stiller on his show. Who was told to lose 60 pounds to get the role?
Oh, I read this.
She did.
Also, fuck Cameron Crowe.
She did lose 60 pounds to get the role, and then he gave it to Renee Zellweger.
Oh, wait. What happened? Cameron Crowe told an actress to lose 60 pounds to be in Jerry Maguire?
He's like, this is written for you, but you have to lose the weight in order to play the role.
Oh, my God.
And she did, and then he gave it to Renee Zellweger.
Yeah, I know who it is. It's Janine Garofalo.
Janine Garofalo. Oh, Jesus. How could you be mean to Janine? She's a treasure. It just makes you hate him so much. Even just because it's Janine Garofalo, too.
Man.
He shouldn't say that to anyone.
She's great. I mean, Larry Sanders, so many great things.
It's hard to see her in this part. It would be so different because Janine Garofalo just seems like she doesn't put up with shit.
I don't see her doing like the romantic baloney that Renee Zellweger does.
Yeah.
Like, wait, you want me to say you had me at hello? No. Maybe you had me at explain yourself and your bullshit.
It's also weird because he was like, Katharine Hepburn is the ideal for this role, but she's no longer alive. And I was like, well, the next person I think of after Katharine Hepburn is Janine Garofalo. Like, it's just like, what are you
doing?
We
should do some more Janine Garofalo movies if you like rom-coms.
We should.
Truth About Cats and Dogs.
Yeah, I never
saw it. I saw it in the theater also.
So what company struck a $1.5 million endorsement deal with TriStar Pictures, whom then turned around and threatened legal action because of this film?
I do know this. I saw it. And they did take legal action. Yeah. They sued for $10 million.
Yeah. Reebok. Yeah. Because fuck
Reebok. I was going to let Rob guess, but...
Nah,
I also read it. It's Reebok. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Glad I got some deep cuts on there.
But that was an interesting thing because Reebok gave them $1.5 million and they, as part of the deal, they filmed like what was going to play over
a
the
commercial.
Credits was Rod finally doing a Reebok commercial.
Right.
But
then they took it out and just left in the fuck Reebok.
Yeah. So the only mention of Reebok was him going like, I hate Reebok. So like, you know, I'm not a fan of Reebok. I'm they're probably a bad company and do shady things, but I kind of feel, you know, I side with Reebok on this one. I would be annoyed at that too.
I kind of like
any judge would.
And also like he probably cut it because he didn't want it to seem like too crass or something, but it also like it underscores that this movie is all about like a guy getting a commercial deal. Like that's what we're rooting for, one guy to get a percentage of the money that another guy would make selling shoes. That's what we're rooting for.
Well, shoes is what we get into in Elizabethtown, so don't get too ahead of yourself.
Oh my god, yeah. Okay. What a disaster. I kind of want to watch it.
So Cameron Crowe comes off this movie really, really high because he's like, oh my god, it won Oscars. You know, I was the only director not nominated for Best Director out of the Best Picture nominees.
And that's
but
notoriously
whatever.
A sign of respect.
but whatever, I'll take that hit. And he goes, what made Jerry Maguire great? Probably the fact that he had a really specific job. So I'm going to do that in my next movie with a shoe designer. Is that what it is? Shoe designer?
Yeah.
Cobbler?
It's sort of interesting because Jerry Maguire and Elizabethtown are sort of like two different but similar movies. Like in Jerry Maguire, he makes a very bold statement and it seems like it's a good thing, and everybody loves him, but he loses his job. But in Elizabethtown, he makes a very bold statement with his shoe, and everybody hates him, and he loses his job.
And the impetus for this movie, just some behind the scenes for it, is that Cameron Crowe, after making Singles, people didn't like it. It was a failure. And
it was?
And apparently... Yeah.
Did, why did every yeah. kid I knew in the sixth grade have a cassette of the soundtrack?
Because that's what Cameron Crowe's really good at.
Okay.
Making soundtracks. He should professionally do that. But yeah. And then he found that everyone around him that said, like, we're best friends, you can always count on me, left and was no longer wanting to represent him and no longer wanting to work with him. And the people that stuck around were not the people that he thought would stick around, but they became his true friends. And so he wanted to create a movie about that experience, and he put it in the business of sports agency. But yeah, I think that's like, I like the impetus of that for this film. I think a lot of people can recognize the false friendships.
I also feel like that makes sense because it also kind of, you know, it informs this movie's sense of like entitlement, you know, like Tom Cruise is this guy who has all this money and, you know, everything seems to come easy to him. And then like one slightly bad thing happens to him. And it's like all about like, how do I get this thing back? This thing that I need and deserve. And, you know, like, and so like Cameron Crowe, and I don't know a lot about Cameron Crowe, but like, yeah, he was kind of like this boy genius guy who had all this early success and, you know, he made all these iconic films. And then, yeah, that makes sense. Like he had one movie that maybe didn't do quite as well. And he like, yeah, the fact that he would treat it as like this huge thing. I don't know. I can see that. That's part of my problem with the movie, I guess. It's just like this sense of like hardship that Tom Cruise projects,
right?
And then it's like, no, I don't care about Jerry Maguire.
He's a titular character. How can you not?
Just looking at Cameron Crowe's filmography too. Aloha, we mentioned Elizabethtown. We mentioned he directed We Bought a Zoo.
Yeah,
did you guys watch that one?
No,
I don't want to spoil it for you, but they buy a zoo.
Oh, that's crazy.
He's pretty good with his titles. He's pretty good with his titles. Okay. So, let's go around. I think I might have an inkling of what you guys might say about this movie, but let's go to you, Rob, first. Do you think this movie is rewatchable?
You know, I don't know, man. I gave it a chance.
Yeah.
Blaine, I know
that's all
we
ask on this podcast. That's all we ask.
And, you know, I respect you, and I respect your opinions, and I also know that, like, you know, sometimes we love things for reasons that aren't necessarily connected to their quality. Sometimes sometimes things connect with us for certain reasons, and, you know, sometimes it's hard to, like, show other people what those things are because other people are not you. I think that there's a lot
to
this
movie. I feel
like
I'm getting broken up with. Jesus.
Well,
you're putting the gloves on. So.
It's not you. This is why
Cameron
we're doing
Crow.
This in a public place. So you can't make a scene.
Oh, my God.
But, I had to be honest. Like, I didn't love this movie. And I think it's interesting because, yeah, like, with Almost Famous, that's a movie that I connect with. I connect with all the themes and like the music and everything in that movie. And so it's hard for me to be critical of it. But with this, I feel like I have the chance to sort of like look at the same sort of thing and be like, oh, everything that's wrong with this movie is probably also wrong with Almost Famous. So, I mean, in that sort of way, it's really interesting. I might give this another watch. I mean, I think that there are some nice moments in here. It's not easy to root for a character who is very well off and, you know, his problem is that his, like, income has been decreased by, like, a couple $1 million. Like, oh, no, you know, it's like most of us will never see that kind of money. So it's really hard to empathize.
He still has an office by the beach.
Like,
what? At one point he says, you know, put these muffins out there and maybe someday we can afford a better office. I was like, what are you talking about? You could walk into the ocean from here in your suit. Like, what? Yeah. Anyway.
I mean, he can probably, like, the whole thing with, like, the healthcare for Renee Zellweger, it's probably not that he can't afford it. It's probably just that he wants to make more money. Come on, like, let's be honest. He's just, you know, it's all about money. Show him the money. But anyway, I don't know. I'm going to say mildly rewatchable because I think it is a very well-constructed movie. There's bits that I like. Sometimes Cameron Crowe is really good at, like, getting the atmosphere. Like, when we first see, like, the divorcees sort of talking in a circle, I was like, oh, this is a really interesting, like, almost anthropological sort of look, you know, at women who have, like, gone through divorce, which is really hard. But then he's just, like, mean to them.
Yeah.
So it's like, But I don't know. I'm going to say
his
mildly
mom was
rewatchable.
One of them. His mom was,
he?
Was one. Yeah.
Was she?
Yeah. Aww. She's the lady that says, I really got in touch with my anger. So mildly rewatchable. Okay.
Mildly rewatchable.
Jan?
I hate this movie. I hate you for making me watch this movie again.
I hate anyone that likes this movie.
I don't know what to say. I mean, I honestly think the best part of the movie is Cuba Gooding Jr. And I feel that like that's tainted now by the multiple allegations against him, and he's probably a terrible person.
So
even the best part of this movie is...
allegation.
But I mean, putting that aside, I think there's just big problems with this movie. It's asking, especially watching it now as an adult, like asking me to cheer for this like wealthy, privileged, mediocre white guy who thinks that, he deserves all of these luxuries.
He's fighting for his silver platter.
Yeah, he's fighting to get luxury back. And I just don't care for it. And it's not even like his thing is a thing that I can get behind in the same way. Like, he's a sports agent, which is just like, it's not even like, you know, he has some kind of skill that you're rooting for. It's like his whole thing is like, I'm going to try to be nice to people so they can make more money. And it's, I don't know. I have problems with this movie on fundamental levels. And I think it fails all of the female characters. And I know as a mediocre white man myself, like maybe I'm not in the best position to critique that. But I do think that like the Renee Zellweger character is I know the next movie, like Elizabeth Town, is the movie that prompted the coining of the phrase Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yeah.
But I feel like that is kind of at play a little bit here too. I know it's not exactly the same thing. We see her life and she is a single mother and she lives with her sister, but it is all this, it's this fantasy where like, where the Jerry Maguire character doesn't have to like face any real repercussions for like the genuinely bad things he does. So I think like she is just a bit of like a wish fulfillment fantasy woman in that way, though I like her as an actress actually, and you know this was like a breakout role for her, and I like, you get why she's very charming and she's very good, and it's hard to play off Tom Cruise when he's acting like fucking Al Pacino in Scarface some of these scenes. and also like we haven't talked that much about like, you know, one of the biggest stars who was in this movie now is Regina King, and you know, she's great,
she's so good,
but like again, like I don't, you know, one thing we didn't talk about is Cameron Crowe recently said like, oh, I have an idea for a Jerry Maguire sequel, and it would be all about Regina King's character. And it's like, oh, that's nice.
Okay.
Now, 25 years later, when that actress happens to be a big star, you have some ideas for her, some things her character could do, as opposed to just be like aggressive and loud and kind of this cartoon character who, doesn't have any depth beyond what, you know, what she brings to it. And she's great. Like, she's always great. But I don't know. I can't help but feel like this movie, this whole movie felt like a cartoon. I didn't like the characters. I don't, you know, by the end of it, you get into it a little, you know, like when you hope Cuba Gooding Jr. is okay and you want Tom Cruise to go back and, you know, be with the family and everything to be happy at the end. I kind of, by the end of it, I felt like, you know, if you're in like a restaurant, when we used to go to restaurants, but if you're in like a restaurant and like a couple next to you gets engaged and they make a big scene and it's noisy and it's like, ah, this is annoying and I'm sure I don't like these people, but I wish them well. I kind of feel like the whole thing that whole thing applies to this. Like, you know, I don't really like these characters, but I wish them the best and I never want to think about them ever again.
Okay, so rewatchable. I'm much like you, JM. I think it's rewatchable as well. I see all the faults, and watching this time was a little bit painful to see a movie that I had such fond memories of in the light of day, and seeing this character that didn't have a lot of redeeming qualities. I mean, I think Bill Murray can pull that off. I think Tom Hanks can pull that off. I don't think Tom Cruise can.
Well, he's not playing like an anti-hero. I think we're just supposed to like him.
Well, he's playing a guy that's trying to live up to
an ideal.
The empathy that he had one night, you know? And and as a pitch for a movie, I think that's amazing. But yeah, it does fall short of that in a lot of places. I think Cameron Crowe can write dialogue really well. Like, I really love the line, you know, no one has ever dumped me. And Tom Cruise says, I'm not trying to make history here. Like, there's some, like, really fun dialogue in there. And yeah, and lines.
That's a good line.
And lines that resonated with audiences for years.
True, yeah. We didn't talk that much about, like, some of the big pop culture lines. We didn't say, help me help you.
Yeah, you complete me. You know, the Joker said that to Batman. Like, I don't know. Like, it's
yeah, that's a pretty potent phrase.
It's true. Like, it's become huge.
I did find it weird just because I forgot it was a callback to, like, when they were in the elevator together. It's weird that it wasn't, like, a callback to, like, their first date or something romantic. It was like, oh, yeah, remember that time we were in the elevator together when, like, I was engaged and, like, barely knew your name?
Yeah, but it is the moment where they first kind of bet on each other. Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, no, I see what you're saying. Yeah, it's a completely flawed movie. It's crass at times, especially with the groping. Regina King and Cuba Gooding Jr. are like the standouts. They're so good, and their relationship is so good, and they work so well together on screen. And yeah, I was going to say before you said that he was talking about a sequel that I would watch a movie of those two characters, maybe in 2018. But now time has passed. So yeah, I think it's rewatchable. I really do. I think it was such a major milestone movie in Hollywood and almost one of the last, it was one of the last big romance comedies.
But it's not funny, and the romance is terrible.
Yeah, I know.
How can it be
you.
A rom-com when it's got none of those things that rhyme?
I'm sorry. I can't help you. That's how it marketed itself. And then things is like really, really changed in the movie business. So I think it's kind of a time capsule too. I think it's worth rewatching. But we'll let the audience decide whether I defended this movie well enough, even through all its faults.
You know, the best defense is a good offense, Blaine.
I know. I should have come
Is that
back
from Jerry Maguire?
That's the famous line from Jerry Maguire when he's talking about his relationship with Renee Zellweger. All right. Thank you so much for listening to Rewatchability this week. You can find us at rewatchability.com. You can go to patreon.com/rewatchability. And if you don't have any change to throw away and you don't want to give the internet your
Some
credit
coin.
Card. Yeah, Quan. Which was the line that he thought would catch on. He was like, Quan is going to be really big. That's really going to catch on. You can just tell a friend about the podcast. That would be really nice. Get our name out there. So
or
thank
your
you
agent.
So much. Or have your agent call us, our agent. We have agents. And they'll get back to you. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.